I also testified, because Democracy Now! Is the last journalist to get into Western Sahara, and we did a documentary called 4 Days in Western Sahara, Africa's Last Colony. What people are calling for here?
They're calling for respect for human rights of the people of Western Sahara. They're calling for the UN to have a monitoring system, human rights monitoring system, which they do not in Western Sahara. They're calling for a chance to have a referendum on self-determination for Sahrawis to decide their future. They've been waiting for over 30 years for this. And
the significance of this side panel hearing?
It's important to have also South Africa supporting the Sahrawi people. South Africa is a longtime supporter of liberation movements around the world, and it has always been on the side of the Sahrawi people.
We'll be doing more on this, and Pekun can check out the documentary, 4 Days in Western Sahara, Africa's Last Colony, at democracynow.org. Maria Carrion, thank you so much. Back to you, Nermeen, in New York.
And that does it for the show. I'm Nermeen Sheikh with Amy Goodman for another edition of Democracy Now! Special thanks to Poon Echevarri, Romain, and François in Geneva. And a very happy birthday to Isis Phillips. We're hiring for multiple positions. Please see democracynow.org jobs.
You're tuned to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
Tune in to Pathways, a show featuring conversations with leaders in personal development and cultural evolution. Join me, host Paul O'Brien, or my co-host Donald Altman, every Sunday morning from 8:30 to 9 a.m. You can find out more about the show or listen to the program archive at kboo.fm/pathway.
From Pacifica Radio in San Francisco, this is Flashpoints. I'm Dennis Bernstein. Today on the show, longtime human rights activist, civil rights activist Juan Jose Gutierrez returns for an update on the emerging police state tactics brought to bear on millions of brown people who live and work in L.A. and parts south. Also, Gazans face mass dying from hunger and thirst. Meanwhile, over 200 murdered in the last 5 days. And on the Iran war front, has corporate media become a cheerleader for war and regime change in Iran? All this and more coming up straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. A lot on our plate today. This is your daily investigative news magazine. We're coming to you over the Pacifica Radio Network. That's KPFA in the Bay Area. That's free speech, non-corporate, no holds barred, truth to power radio. And we are going to start in Los Angeles with Juan Jose Gutierrez, who is a longtime immigration rights activist, really frontline activist, has led and participated in many organizations, programs for immigrants in Los Angeles, the state of California, and the United States of America. Also joining us is our own senior producer, Miguel Gavilan Molina. Juan Jose Gutierrez, welcome back to Flashpoints. We watched a bizarre incident, a violent incident that really represents the new police state. And of course, it's manifesting in Los Angeles in the case of Narciso Barranco, who was beaten by masked, we think they're ICE, who knows what the hell they were, who they were, beaten to the ground for no good reason and dragged away, and it was filmed. That's an indication of where we are, isn't it?
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Sorry to start with that, but that's where we are, right?
Yeah, thank you for inviting me. Glad to be back with you. Yes, I would have to agree that this is an ongoing evolution of the establishment of a police state in the United States of America by the Donald Trump administration, because what happened and what people viewed in the video that you describe that directly caused injuries to the person of Mr. Narciso Barranco is not exclusive to that one incident that you describe. Now we have situations that are too many to mention. I'll mention some to add to your description of the establishment of a police state in America. Let me mention what happened over the weekend in the city of Santa Ana, California. For those that don't know where Santa Ana is located, well, it's adjacent to the city of Anaheim, California, and that's where Disney World in California is located, renowned across the world as a place of entertainment. Well, there, in the last few days, we also witnessed other videos that circulated in social networks where a gardener who was working and who happened to be the father of three U.S. servicemen serving in different branches of the U.S. Armed Forces was slammed to the ground. His shoulder was dislocated. He was beaten up, forced onto what I believe to be an ICE vehicle. But like you say, who knows who the hell these people are anymore, as we now have bounty hunters, private citizens who claim to have been deputized by U.S. immigration authorities to go after immigrants, presume undocumented workers, arrest them, and if successful, turning them over to immigration authorities, they are collecting $1,000 a head, as they so viciously have said. So here's a father of three U.S. Servicemen who was beaten without any mercy. Obviously, his children are appalled. And that's just one example. Also, over the weekend in the city of Torrance, here in Southern California, near one of our many beaches that we have here, approximately 20, according to witnesses, about 20 bounty hunters attempted to arrest undocumented workers working at a car wash. Both the employer and a very courageous employee confronted these bounty hunters and impeded any undocumented person being arrested. You know, they ran and got away, but these bounty hunters went and arrested other individuals in other local businesses nearby. You know, those are just two examples of what's going on. And this morning, as I was participating in a press conference that I will describe shortly, Dennis, immigration agents and presumed private citizens, you know, bounty hunters, continue their campaign of terror, running wild through commercial areas where large numbers of Latinos typically congregate to buy articles of various types for their homes and for themselves. And again, they proceeded to arrest presumed undocumented workers without adhering to due process rules and regulations that have been acknowledged in this country for a long, long time. When it comes to presumed undocumented workers, and I want to underscore that, presumed, because since there are no arrest warrants signed by judges of any type, one has to assume that a vast number of the arrestees of those individuals that are being arrested could be undocumented persons, but we don't know. And so in the meantime, the situation in Southern California remains very tense, very explosive, because the demonstrations across the Southland are nonstop. They continue and will continue so long as this clear violation of the civil and constitutional rights of our undocumented brothers and sisters continues unabated. The only good news, and I will end my first intervention then, is by saying that the Donald Trump administration from yesterday to today ordered agents of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the FBI, to return to their usual place of operations in the buildings of the FBI, because they're concerned that given the bombing of Iran by both Israel and ourselves, the United States of America, you know, that there could be problems in the Southland, because I don't know if you know this, but in Southern California, we have the largest community of Iranians in the world. Over 500,000 Iranians make their home in Southern California.
Juan Jose, I just want to follow up on one thing, and I want to bring our good brother Miguel Gavilan Molina in. But how, in practical terms, I mean, the beatings are one thing. How is this reverberating at home in the homeland with people's lives? Are people not working anymore? Are they staying home? Are they afraid to go to work? Are children afraid to go to school? Can you help us understand how this is shaking down at the grassroots?
Well, at the grassroots, Dennis, we have a very bad situation. Let me break it down for you. Clearly, the immigrant community at large is gripped by fear, anxiety, and anguish. You know, they're frightened, and some of the ramifications that we have been talking about for days now is the fact that people are going so far as to skip work. They're not going to work. Another consequence of what's going on is that immigrant parents are not sending their U.S.-born children to school, because they're afraid with all this information and misinformation that they hear on social networks, on the news, et cetera, that their children could be targets, because it's known that immigration agents have arrested, have abused U.S. citizens who have been incarcerated after being beaten and in some case even deported. So all this has created a collective psychosis that has forced many individuals, in their fear, to prevent their children from going to school. They're not going to hospitals or clinics when they feel ill. They rather remain ill, that risk going to get medical attention for fear that they might be arrested by immigration authorities there. They're not going to the supermarkets. They're sending their U.S.-born children, who are adolescents, you know, to buy the food that they typically would buy themselves and take home for the week. And so it is just an outrageous mess. And it's a very, very sad situation that ultimately adds fuel to what I described in previous interviews as something that I view as a very explosive social situation that can blow up if not stopped soon. So, yes, you know, at the grassroots, everybody's feeling the consequences of the actions, both legal and illegal, most of them illegal in my view, no respect for due process, and just indiscriminate persecution, arrest, incarceration, and deportations of immigrants.
Wow. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with our good friend Juan Jose Gutierrez, and we're talking about, well, the crackdowns that we know are going on all over the country. Later on in this broadcast, we're going to play you some sounds from what was going on here in the Bay Area, where ICE was at it again, and they were meeting with some resistance. Dennis Bernstein here with Miguel Gavilan Molina. Miguel, join us.
Absolutely. Good to hear your voice, Juan Jose. My question
Thank you for the invite.
No, igualmente. My biggest concern, you know, we've seen the beatdown recently of the man with, you know, the three sons that are part of the military, Marines and so forth. And we saw less than a week ago the beatdown of Alex, you know, Senator Alex Padilla. So anybody brown, you know, is going to be subject to being criminal or to being undocumented or being a terrorist or, you know, being a rebel, whatever this administration wants, which is just based on hatred and racism. With that said, we've seen that anybody, brown profiling is back. And that's what, you know, these law enforcement, militarized police, the Marines are using, brown profiling. With that and that beatdown, I know also, one will say, just from the Bay Area here and Northern California throughout the state, that the economy in the Latino communities is taking a beating, you know, by what's happening. There's a backlash. People are afraid to go shopping. People are afraid to spend money. Have you seen any of that where there's businesses getting threatened or shutting down because of the militarization of Southern California?
Yes, Miguel and Dennis. The economy, the local economy in Southern California, and I suspect across the state, is taking a big hit. But let me localize it and speak about what is actually going on in the economy of Southern California. You know, this morning I went to a press conference to support restaurant owners who are being hit hard and are not being able to generate the usual cash flow that enable them to meet payroll, etc. Let me give a specific example. There's a Nicaraguan-owned restaurant in the Pico Union area, which is a little bit west of downtown L.A., which is, you know, it's part of what is known as the Central American corridor here in Southern California. Well, that's where this restaurant is located. It's called La 27 Restaurant. And there, you know, that restaurant has been providing services to the community for the last 33 years. It was founded by immigrants from Nicaragua who, after much work and sacrifice, and obviously with the labor of a growing labor force in their restaurant, you know, they grew to, up until recently, they had 33 employees. Obviously, most of them have families that depend for their livelihood on their labor and work for this restaurant. You know, in less than, let's say in the last month, they've gone from 33 employees to 3 employees during the week, Monday through Friday, as they told the press today, and on Saturdays, 4 employees and the owners, right? So, you know, that's one example. There's a bakery in the city of Compton, which is not that close to downtown L.A. You know, it used to be a predominantly African American community. Now it is about 90% Latino, and there, this bakery, they used to have a monthly cash flow of $80,000. It's lucky to be generating $5,000-$6,000 dollars in business, in any 1 week. So clearly, those are just two examples of many that could be mentioned. Local economy is taking a big, big hit. People are losing their jobs. Families are desperate and don't know what's going to happen with the parents' jobs, etc. How, you know, and then the worries come. How am I going to pay rent? How am I going to pay for the food for our family, clothing, etc., the basic necessities of life? So this is another major ramification, which is a direct result of these neo-fascist policies that the Donald Trump administration is pursuing in its quest, brown profile individuals and make them all into dangerous criminals that must be arrested and deported, and to the extent possible, far away. And that's where the recent decision by the Supreme Court of the United States, 6-3, yesterday, you know, basically empowered the president to send people not just to that horrendous prison, the Secote, in San Salvador, but to faraway places in Africa, in the nation of Libya, which is still undergoing civil war, Morocco, and other such places, you know, where people's lives, you know, are in danger, not just of losing their lives, but, you know, in the best of cases, undergoing, you know, dire torture and things of that nature. So this is just a big, big mess that has the whole community full of fear and anxiety.
Well, you know, part of the fear, Juan Jose, is the uncertainty. But what about the local politicos? What about Mayor Bass and others? Are they requiring, or is there a process to, let's say, you know, force the administration at least to have the mercenaries, you know, take off their masks, at least to have some kind of ID? I mean, you know, the mercenaries are secret police. And once you, you know, who authorized them? Is there a process to put them under check or get some kind of legal, you know, protocols to, you know, at least find out who these individuals are, how they got certified, you know, how did they get deputized, and who's paying the bounty? That's $1,000. That's almost unbelievable that they're, you know, and there's a lot of rumors and talk that some of these mercenaries are some of those, you know, members, the 1,600 that were, you know, convicted and imprisoned, you know, and then when the current dictator Trump came into power, he pardoned them and called them patriots and released them. Well, there's a lot That's of right. rumors that a lot of those now are working as mercenaries. What is the local government doing to at least stop that and force them to identify themselves, credentialed, or be accountable?
Well, I'm sorry to say that at this point, I don't think that process is already taking place, where local government or county government is taking measures to make, you know, to make absolutely certain that the due process rights of individuals who are going to be stopped, you know, maybe even arrested and incarcerated, you know, it's been upheld. But what is taking place, Miguel, is that the talk that you're referring to is underway. It's taking place, right? And it's amplifying. In other words, it's growing in intensity, so much so that at least some action is beginning to take place. Now, we know that at the state level, the state legislature, whether it's the Assembly or the Senate, is beginning to articulate pieces of legislation that are moving through the legislative process to make it obligatory that all these secret agents masquerading as bounty hunters, etc., mercenaries, actually identify themselves and do not cover their faces. We have to know who these individuals are. You know, the legislation presumably is going to include a requirement that they have to identify themselves. Any individual that pretends to arrest or to even detain a presumed undocumented person has to identify themselves and begin by not covering their face as they have been doing up until now. Now, on the other hand, at the very, very local level, I know that Mayor Karen Bass is under immense pressure from different quarters, to follow suit and to come up with some more concrete measures, that will safeguard the rights and the integrity of the immigrant community, which in L.A., we have the largest concentration of immigrants, documented and undocumented, anywhere in the nation. But that hasn't happened yet. She's made a lot of good statements on the record, but that still leaves a lot that must and can be done, but it's not happening yet.
Juan Jose, this is Dennis Bernstein here with Miguel Gavilan Molina. We're running out of time, but there's one incredibly important story that is breaking as we were coming to air, and there were revelations. Let me read you a couple of the first two paragraphs. Yeah. A top official at the Justice Department told subordinates they would need to consider ignoring court orders the day before the administration carried out deportations under the Alien Enemies Act, according to a department whistleblower. In a letter sent to Congress by his attorneys, Erez Ruvenar, this is a right-winger, this is a real right-winger, said he and others were told by Principal Associate Deputy Attorney General Emil Beauvais in very blunt terms that they might have to defy court orders. In other words, lie to carry out these deportations. Your response?
Well, my response is that this is part of the unbelievable and incredible evolution of how dictatorship is taking hold in the United States of America. Miguel Gavilan Molina just mentioned for everyone to hear once again what happened to Senator Alex Padilla, how they demeaned and humiliated him inside an official press conference of the Secretary of Homeland Security, Christine Moen. Then you have the president, Donald Trump, ordering ICE agents and other federal agents, who are participating in this national campaign of raids that are most intense in Southern California and the city of L.A., that they must up the ante, and from 1,200, they must increase their total number of arrested and incarcerated immigrants, and of course, their quick deportation from 1,200. A little bit over 1,200 through to 3,000. So it doesn't surprise to me now that these managers of the employees of the immigration branches of government, are telling, their managers that they tell their employees, ICE agents and border patrolmen, that they are violating, the norms because they're not supposed to be this far north from the border, carrying out arrests and deportations, but they're doing it anyway. And now they're being told, look, we got a quota that we have to meet, and so it doesn't matter if you defy court orders. If that's what it comes down to, do it. I mean, what more evidence do we need, to be concerned that what we're seeing over these first 5 months of government of the Donald Trump administration is the establishment of a dictatorship, a police state, and ultimately a fascist government. So we must be very concerned by this and follow the example of what's going on in Southern California. There's lots of resistance. We saw the No Kings marches in 2,100 cities. We have to keep organizing and uniting because only a united people, all of us together, are going to be able to stand a chance of turning things around and stopping this fascist administration.
Juan Jose Gutierrez, we always appreciate your visits to Flashpoints. The people of this radio network need the information that you're sharing with us, and we're going to continue this dialogue as we follow the resistance. Thanks for joining us today. We appreciate it.
Dennis, thank you very much for the invite.
Thank you so much. And we want to play for everybody. We're going to skip the music break here. Oh, we've got some sound from Free Will and Frank, the ICE or somebody with badges and violence on their mind was out arresting people in the Bay Area. And Free Will and Frank has a little bit of sound having to do with that. Listen to this.
All right, Free Will and Franklin here reporting for KPFA and Flashpoint. And a lot going on here in the Bay Area. It seems that there was ICE activity at the Concord Immigration Court again today. A lot seems to be happening on Tuesdays. And as far as I can gather, at least four people were taken from the Concord Immigration Court and snuck out a side door by ICE agents, stuffed into vehicles, and whisked away to San Francisco, where they were met by other protesters in San Francisco at the ICE field office there. Joining me is B, who was on the ground in San Francisco. And as far as I could understand, B, from following in the chat group, is that there was the people from Concord that were abducted out here were transported to San Francisco, and they were met by some protesters there trying to stand up for our brothers and sisters, our immigrant brothers and sisters. Tell us, B, first of all, thank you for joining us, and tell us what you saw there in San Francisco.
So I was there after the people, our neighbors, were taken into the jail. But what we did was we surrounded the building because it's public space and we can peacefully, or we can gather. It's our constitutional right to gather. And we saw ICE agents, we saw police, and it did get pretty rough. The ICE agents, or maybe we'll just call them vigilante justice people, pretty much were surrounded, and we were trying to keep them from leaving because the word is they're going back out to Concord or other places to take our neighbors. And so they would threaten people with their batons. And, you know, we just need more people to be there on watch and keeping these folks from acting in this illegal way, because the police aren't going to do it is the thing. They're there too.
And so much as it goes for the sanctuary city in San Francisco, as they say.
That's right. That's right. And we also heard that our mayor was on scene. And so I don't think anyone of the activists got to speak with him. But I'm really curious what Mayor Lurie is going to do about these people who don't have badges. They don't tell us who they are. They are masked and they are kidnapping people. And then the police are upholding it all, letting them in back doors, you know, put a paddy wagon into the building, which we couldn't stop from happening on our side. So we need more people. We need more people finding their neighbors and their community to help stop this from happening in our sanctuary city.
All right, V, thanks for the update. Before I let you go, just give me the short version of, you know, what's got you out there. Before we started recording, you told me this is like your first action. What is it that finally got you in the street there to confront ICE?
I mean, I've protested since the Iraq War. I was probably the oldest person on this street there today. But what I'm saying is we know that this is going to get violent. So a direct action like this, I'm new to that. And I will keep doing it to the best of my ability. Tyranny, it will not stand in this country. As long as I remain on this soil, I'll fight for trans lives. I'll fight for all the global majority people who I love dear and those that I don't love, that I don't know. I love all of them. I may not know you, but you're my brother and sister. So that's
great,
it.
Great words. And just again, a quick update. Four people were abducted from the ICE immigration office and whisked away to San Francisco in unmarked ICE vehicles, where they were met by protesters. There was a confrontation on the street. But again, B, thanks for joining us. Thanks for being out there and having your body on the line. As you said, standing up for our neighbors, our brothers and sisters. We appreciate it.
Of course. Thank you.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Thank you, Free Will and Frank. We appreciate the information. Obviously, these sweeps are happening across California and around the country. This is profoundly serious. People in masks, unmarked vehicles, don't know where they're going, don't know when they're being taken, being beaten in the case of Los Angeles. These are difficult times, and KPFA, Flashpoints, and Pacifica Radio are going to be there covering the story as best as we can. Let's do this. Let's take a short break, and then we're going to turn our attention back to what's going on in Gaza. And remember that war that the Trump administration just conducted against Iran? More on all of that. Stay tuned. To Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We turn our attention back to Iran, the war, and the killing fields of Gaza, and that's really what they are now. Joining us again is Jennifer Lowenstein. Lowenstein is a former Associate Director of Middle Eastern Studies and Senior Lecturer at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She founded the Madison-Rafa Sister City Project, and we're happy to have her. Welcome back, Jennifer. These continue to be terrible times. We are hearing sort of after reports, the Trump administration attack on Iran. We were hearing it was the end of their nuclear program. I think, are they now talking about a setback of 6 months to 2 years? I don't know. Do we really know what happened there?
Yeah, we do, actually, and more information is coming out. And all of the information I've seen so far is in agreement with the fact that the Iranian nuclear program has been at most set back by a few months. All of the uranium that was enriched to 60% at the Fordo and Natanz nuclear plants was removed before the strikes and is now in undisclosed locations. And that means that Iran, if you enrich uranium to 90%, you've got weapons-grade uranium. And that makes you, at least theoretically, only a few weeks away from a bomb. And, you know, my own feeling is that if the Iranians learned anything from this war, if you can call it that, it's that they need a nuclear bomb. And I think that is a very sad reality. I think the Iranians have come to realize, as many other people in the world have, that without a strong enough deterrent to U.S. power, which I include Israel in that, you have no defense unless you can deter U.S. power, and the way to do that is with a nuclear weapon. So, you know, I suspect that it will be very likely in the coming months and years, maybe, that Iran will in fact move towards the production of a nuclear weapon. And that's where we are. We have an agreement without an agreement. Two sides were pretty much made to stop fighting through a phone call by Donald Trump. But there was no written agreement, no verifications process, no handshake or discussion about what the terms of this agreement should be. So everything is ambiguous. Everything is left up to guessing. And so this is why I consider this ceasefire to be a little more than an excuse for buying time. That's what I would call it.
Yes, and we can sort of call it a limited ceasefire because the attacks on Palestinians in Gaza and defenseless, we might say, starving, we might say, dying of thirst soon if things don't change. So this has been, among other things, an extraordinary distraction for the Prime Minister of Israel. It's a terrible situation on the ground. You want to talk a little bit about the implications for what's continuing there?
The implications are all so negative and ugly that I even like to avoid them. I mean, to me, that 2 million people are still suffering in Gaza the way that they are by being deprived food and water and fuel and electricity and being killed every day in the dozens at these alleged aid distribution sites, that there's no fuel going into Gaza, and that means that the water sanitation infrastructure, which has been 80% destroyed, is going to be working at what still exists cannot operate without fuel. You can't produce water. You can't pump it from wells if there's no fuel. And so on top of there being a looming famine, and frankly, for about, half a million people, they're already in a terrible famine. North Gaza is an absolute wasteland. And it's a shame, really. It's a stain on the conscience of humanity. That's what I have to call it. An absolute stain on our conscience. But on top of being starved, we can expect to hear about people dying of thirst and of dehydration and of the diseases that come with dehydration. Things like cholera, things like dysentery. I mean, I don't know. I'm not a doctor. I can't explain it technically. But this is what's looming in Gaza now, because the water infrastructure has been ruined. UNICEF basically has said that what's happening in Gaza is a man-made drought, because the fuel to operate wells and desalination plants isn't there. And as I said, 40% of drinking water production facilities are what's available. I wanted to mention, not everyone is familiar with the climate in Gaza. Because I lived there, I can say very, I can tell people very clearly what it's like. In the summertime, it's sweltering. It's in the 90s every day. But on top of that, because it's a coastal enclave, the humidity is extremely high. So, summer heat can be absolutely beastly. And this is what, a million kids are going to be facing, because the population of Gaza is at least 50% under age of 25. So again, we're talking about a very young population being the primary targets of this genocide. And the silence around the world towards what's happening, to me, gets more horrifying every day, because the killing doesn't stop. The bombing and strafing of the strip isn't stopping. The killing of anyone caught breathing at the aid distribution sites happens every day. 86 Palestinians killed today, 56 of them at a distribution site. Why does this happen? Why is this continuing to happen?
86 today. 86 today.
Yes, today. It's been almost 100 people per day every day. I mean, the numbers.
So the food
are
is being used, really, the food is being used, it's sort of like a mousetrap, right? The food is being used to draw people out. It appears that this is, it's not about feeding the people who are desperate for food. It's become a tactical way that the Israelis are doing, if you will, population control.
Yeah, I mean, I see it as a kind of twisted version of the Hunger Games, if you will. I mean, the Hunger Games were already a twisted version on society. But, I mean, this is just, it's unbelievable. People, literally, people are being told, you can go and try to get a bag of food that will last maybe a week and maybe will feed your whole family. Because let's not forget, the food being distributed at this site is not sufficient, is not the most nutritional, and not everybody is getting it because there are a lot of people who won't go to these lines for the very reason that they don't want to put their lives in their hands, or in the hands of the Israelis, to be more accurate. But yeah, I mean, this is happening every single day. You want some food? Well, come to one of these four aid distribution sites, three in Rafah, one at the Netzarim corridor halfway through Gaza, and see if you can get a bag of flour without being shot dead while you're doing it.
It's disgusting. It's really frightening to think that this is
policy. Have you heard anyone, Macron, Mertz, Starmer, anyone say anything about this? Because I haven't. I haven't heard a single politician in weeks talk about this program, and it's just horrifying.
Okay, we're going to leave it there for now. Jennifer Lowenstein, as always, we appreciate you. The important information you continue to share with us based on your experience, long experience, on the violence that surrounds every aspect of domination in Palestine and U.S. support for ethnic cleansing and now genocide, and people could very well start dying of thirst. I think there's one or two cases already reported, but we're going to watch that.
I'm sure there have been.
Yeah. All right, Jennifer, stay safe. We'll talk to you soon, okay?
Yep. Thank you.
You're absolutely welcome and appreciated. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Let's take a short break. When we come back, we're going to talk about how the New York Times gave the green light to Trump's Iran attack by treating it as a question of when. I am really glad that Bryce Green has written this article for FAIR. Stay with us. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Well, I've been watching this for some time, and it's not surprising to me that the corporate press becomes a cheerleader for war. They make a lot of money on wars. They misreport wars, or they hardly report them at all in terms of what's really happening. The genocide that's going on now. in Gaza, the West Bank, occupied Palestine, is an example. And this current attack on Iran was worse than I've seen in the all the cheerleading over all the recent wars. This was pretty amazing, and they're still cheering. The corporate press wants more war here. Joining us, as I said, I'm going on here. Joining us, as I said, is Bryce Green. He's written an article. New York Times gave green light to Trump's Iran attack by treating it as a question of when. Could you elaborate on that title? Welcome, Bryce Green. Tell us a little bit. Set it up for us.
Thank you for having me on. Hey, I wrote this article sure. because I was scrolling the New York Times page and I saw an editorial from an entire editorial board. That's all of their opinion columnists, their standard opinion columnists. And the title of the article was saying America should not rush into a war with Iran. Now, at first glance, that might sound like an article that decries the idea of America going to war in Iran and talking about how maybe we should rethink it and we shouldn't do that and there should be a different strategy. But that's not what the New York Times meant. They chose their words very carefully. They didn't say that Trump shouldn't attack Iran or that America shouldn't be bombing other countries around the world. They said that we shouldn't rush into it, as in bombing Iran might be justified, but we might want to take a little bit more time to assess and consider that decision. Their main criticism of Trump, well, it wasn't the violent imperialism of going to bomb unprovoked a country halfway around the world that is in no way threatening us. Their criticism was that Trump did not stick to the procedural methods of going through Congress to authorize the bombing of a new country. That was their critique. And so that's really not a critique of the policy, but rather a critique of how it's done. It's not saying we shouldn't attack Iran. It's saying we should slow down before we do it too quickly.
Style. the idea, I mean, it's sort of like a gotcha Republican versus Democrat. We know that presidents, the Bushes and all of them have abused, expanded presidential power. It's been, the battle cry of the sort of the corporate journalists in their attempts to hold the various administrations accountable. But really, it is an extraordinary effort for the corporate press to report a story like this, in which you have, and I'm beating that dead horse again, in which you have a nuclear renegade declaring war on another country because they might sometime in the future get nuclear weapons. They're probably more likely to get them now than before. But at the idea, you've got Israel, the nuclear renegade, no inspections, leading the charge with the United States of America, who has enough nuclear weapons to get rid of all of us forever and ever. So there's a bizarre thing going on here. That seems to be what you are driving at. Say more about that.
Right. What I think I'm capturing is one layer of a propaganda campaign against the entire American public. This campaign is designed to get the American audiences, the people who read the newspapers, the well-meaning liberal types, to accept the policy of world domination that includes bombing other countries, that includes aggressive military expansion, and disregard for international law. And this propaganda campaign is based on a number of multi-layered lies. One of those lies, chief among them, is that Iran is working hard to produce a nuclear bomb. Now, as we've seen from U.S. intelligence as recently as a few months ago, there's no evidence that Iran is working on a nuclear bomb. There is no evidence whatsoever to suggest that. The IAEA head said explicitly that they did not find evidence of Iran building and working on or even planning to work on a nuclear bomb. So that's the first big lie that this propaganda campaign is consisting of. And this was, of course, repeated in the New York Times as a justification for why we might go to war. Another layer of this propaganda campaign is that not only is Iran getting nuclear weapons, but they plan to use them against Israel immediately if they should get them. This claim is based on the idea that Iran is such a crazy and theocratic regime that after, you know, 45 years of fighting for its survival, they would throw it all away just to blow up Israel. Because as you and I and probably everyone else listening knows, if Iran were to attack Israel with a nuclear weapon, Iran would cease to exist within 24 hours. That's not within the regime's interest. That's not within anyone's interest in the Iranian military establishment. In fact, American military put together a study. They commissioned a study from the RAND Corporation analyzing actual texts and military journals and the conversations that Iranians were having in their security sector. And they found that they're very unlikely to use nuclear weapons could they get them in an offensive capacity, because that's not the way they're being talked about. That's not the way they're thought of. They're actually very lousy offensive weapons. But what they would be used for is deterrent capacity. But there's a reason why no one is seriously contemplating attacking North Korea, despite the hawkish American sentiments toward that country. It's because they have nuclear weapons. It's unthinkable to, you know, wipe off Seoul off the map for the purpose of eliminating North Korea. That's just a high cost that they would never take. But they are talking every single day, you see it in the press, about not only attacking Iran, not only bombing its nuclear facilities, but also changing its entire regime, which is extreme. But they wouldn't be doing that if Iran had nuclear weapons. And so that's actually an incentive for Iran to get nuclear weapons. And as the RAND Corporation study found, they would not be used in an offensive capacity. They are designed to deter exactly the kind of attack that Israel and America just launched against Iran. So these are layered lies on top of each other that form this propaganda campaign meant to promote this idea that war against Iran is somehow justified. And this is what the New York Times promoted in their article. They said that, you know, we might want to wait before doing it, but they never said that we shouldn't do it. In fact, they repeated this propaganda line, basically saying exactly what the Trump administration is saying about their reasons for attacking Iran. Well, once you accept that Iran is dangerous and it needs to be attacked, well, then the only logical question is when and what procedure are going to use to do it. And that's what the New York Times disagreed with Donald Trump on.
The when. And that's, yeah, and that was the focus of all the conversations on the corporate networks as well. It was all a discussion. Is he one, or will he take it before Congress and follow various laws in terms of going to war? What's the strategy here, and what will be best for Israel? It really is couched also in what will be best for Israel, while never mentioning again that Israel is a nuclear renegade. It does seem that they are, the corporate press is so well trained that you would never know that Israel is a nuclear renegade. When's the last time you heard them mention that? So are you listening to Flash Points?
I hear it very rarely and sporadically. And, you know, it's often couched in the terms of allegations. Like Israel is believed to have nuclear weapons. Israel is alleged to have nuclear weapons. I mean, it's completely unserious. And it's a yet another layer on this big lie-laden propaganda campaign I'm talking about. The assumption is that because Iran is getting a nuclear weapon, that gives America the right to attack it in the name of security. Let's assume Iran is getting a nuclear weapon. And let's assume that we are a neutral arbiter looking at the world from a God's eye perspective. We see one country get nuclear weapons, and that country is consistently threatening its neighbors, consistently writing in the press about which country to attack next. They keep an entire population under military occupation. They've flouted international law. They've said the Hague will not stop us. They are committing what many human rights organizations have correctly labeled a genocide. We should be worried about them with nuclear weapons first. Iran has never done anything on the scale of Israeli attacks on its neighbors, violence done against the civilian population by military. They've never done anything remotely as brutal and autocratic as Israel has. And yet the idea that Iran is the one we should be worrying about when it gets nuclear weapons is completely laughable when put next to those facts. And that's something you rarely see juxtaposed in the American media because, well, that would give the game away. That would lessen the effectiveness of the propaganda campaign. Well, I don't know if the Times columnists are doing this willingly, knowingly, and intentionally, but if they're not, it means that they're very stupid and they're not very good at the job of commentating on the day-to-day affairs. It's either they are incredibly stupid or they think the general public is incredibly stupid that they wouldn't catch these obvious distortions and misrepresentations. And in fact, the American public is very on a different plane than the corporate media. I looked at all of the news or the opinion headlines and the opinion columns that were published the day after Trump's strike, and not a single one opposed Trump's strike. Well, some might have asked some questions, but you know, I'm talking all the papers. I'm talking USA Today, Washington Post, Chicago Tribune.
All of them. All Street. We did a lot of reporting on that. We're going to have to leave it right there. We really appreciate Bryce Green. Your visit, I want to tell people New York Times gave green light to Trump's Iran attack by treating it as a question of when. He did this, Bryce did this for fairness and accuracy in reporting. We thank you for joining us. Come back again and tell us some more. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio.
Listening to KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM.
Prison Pipeline is a radio program dedicated to educating the public about the Oregon criminal justice system. Topics include incarceration and reentry, addictions and mental health, elections and laws, victims' rights.